member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com. You burst through the door, you find a small room filled with gold and jewels, and a red dragon. He starts to breathe. Save or die!
Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, a podcast about classic Dungeons & Dragons. If it's in a box, we'll talk about it.
Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, adventure number 33. I am one of your hosts, DM Vince, along with DM Glenn.
Wow, 33?
Yeah, we're 33.
That's incredible.
Who would have thought we made it 33 episodes, huh?
Yeah. Makes me feel old. I'm 54 now.
The older gentleman in the back.
Thank you. I remember rolling wood of dice.
Yeah. And with us this week is DM Liz, back by popular Thorky demand.
Yay!
How are we, Liz?
My small but vocal fan base has demanded. doing pretty good.
Speaking of small but vocal fan base, somebody on one of the, I think our new website, requested that you come on the live actual play podcast sometime and play a character.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's what I figured the answer would be.
Yeah.
And sitting in with us this week is a special guest, the creator and writer, author, producer of the BX Companion, Jonathan, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
We're glad to have you, and we want to start off the show, but you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into gaming and that stuff.
Well, I'm in my late 30s. I started gaming back in when I was around 8 or 9 years old. You emailed me these questions. I was trying to think of it. It's hard to remember the exact turn of events. I don't know what it was that hit me to Dungeons & Dragons, but that was my first role-playing game.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I asked my mother to buy it for me. The box set, the Moldvay basic set, the red book. And I was, like I said, about 9 years old. Read it, made an adventure for my younger brother and a friend, and I've been playing off and on ever since. Mm-hmm. I play a variety of different role-playing games. I kind of collect them. I have probably 30 or 40 different ones.
Yeah.
But I didn't play Dungeons & Dragons pretty much from the second edition period all the way till the third edition came out. And then I got back into gaming, and then I got sick of gaming, and then I was out of it for about 7 years. And it was through learning about the old school movement on the internet that kind of got me interested in it again and had me re-examining the games again and getting me interested in playing again. And so I have been playing for the last couple of years now, running games out of my house or down at my local bar.
Cool.
And I'm probably more into it now than I have been since I was 13 or 14 years old.
Sweet.
Nice.
Now, that's the first time I've heard someone mention, I run games out of a local bar. I mean, usually it's your local gaming store or something, but
I tried that, but no one showed up. I tried that. I put up ads at the local game shop, and I went down there like 3 Sundays in a row and hanging out all afternoon waiting for people to show up. No one did. But when I went to the bar, it's like I get new people there every night. Last Thursday I was there, and the bartender was telling me there was someone at the bar who plays down in Ballard and wants to join our game here at the bar. We're up to like 14 or 15 people total.
Wow.
And like, it's kind of crazy because, you know, you read online about people who have a hard time finding games and such, and right now we have an average of 8 people show up a night. The 14 people kind of rotate in and out, and it's hard to turn away anyone. I mean, now that I've rediscovered it, I want to share it with everyone, you know?
How do you go inside of a bar and sit down and just start playing? You're like, hey, here's my stuff, and just wait, or?
Well, you have to have a special bar.
Baranoff,
the Baranoff in Greenwood, is probably like the diviest bar in all of Seattle. It has the longest happy hour in all of Seattle. It starts like 6 a.m. and goes till midnight. And it's one of those, it has a restaurant, and the restaurant closes after 8 o'clock, and then the bar is actually attached to it.
Right.
So we play in the restaurant portion, and I've been a regular down there long enough that they know me or recognize me and know I'm not going to steal their silverware hanging out in the restaurant part. And now we've just been going there for the last few months, and they're used to us coming in on Thursdays and pushing together some tables and setting up.
That's cool.
The first time I went in there was because I'd got back interested in gaming again, and I was trying to meet up with another game group that met at a coffee shop across the street, Emerald City Games, and I got there late, and they'd already started, and so my brother, who was with me, said, why don't we just go play in the bar and across the street and have a beer? And I said, sure, and we've been doing that ever since.
Cool.
More games should be in bars.
Yeah, I agree.
I think so.
Hey, you may be starting a trend.
Yeah, there's been problems lately because they've started trying to do karaoke on Thursdays, and it gets kind of loud.
Well, I'm glad I'm not playing on Thursdays, otherwise I'd be torn.
Oh, yeah. Boy. All right, cool. And just so people get an idea that since you wrote this book, what do you do for a living, if you want to tell us that?
I'm a civil servant for the Washington State government.
Okay, there you have it. Cool. All right, Glenn.
Yeah.
What emails we got this week?
Okay, we got a couple of short ones here. One is from Heath Rowe again. He says, Liz, etc., thanks for riffing on my email and the number, episode 30 podcast. I got a kick out of the whole deal. Based on folks' feedback, I think I'll replay the original Gamma World before I pick up the new Gamma World. Glad to hear the mention of Metamorphosis Alpha. Hope to play that someday myself. Keep up the good work, Heath.
Wait, it's now Liz and etc. now when they write in?
Yeah. Yes, now it's Liz, etc. It's the Liz show. Woo-hoo,
see, you have more than one fan, Liz.
I have just now gained immortality.
Yes.
Absolutely.
They don't talk about that path in the companion rules.
No.
Not yet.
The podcast path.
That's because you and Julie have it locked up.
Yeah. Next one, Glenn.
Okay, Joe Salerno. He basically has a question for us. Hi, just started listening to your podcast. Excellent show. I have been unable to download the MP3 files from your podcast directly from the website. I don't often have the chance to be at my desk long enough to listen to the shows uninterrupted, and I like to download them onto my iPod. Is there any chance you'll be uploading the rest of the shows to iTunes at any point? Thanks. Cheers, Joe.
Well, iTunes doesn't actually hold the episodes. They just pull off the feed. So if people don't request episodes off the feed, it kind of falls off the feed, and you have to go to the website feed itself. Mm-hmm. And you'd actually have to go to the website and click download for each individual episode and then upload it onto your iPod or iPad or wherever.
Yeah, anybody who has a question like that on our message board and stuff, I just direct them to the website.
I'm thinking maybe we might just put the first 20 episodes maybe into like a zip file or something.
Yeah, that's what Julie does. That's a good idea. Here's the early stuff.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that. You can compress files, Glenn, right? Pretty well?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Glenn, I got a project for you.
Yes, you do.
What's our last email for tonight?
No, that's it. That's all our emails this week.
All right, and then finally, you could find us, the new Save or Die podcast forums, at osrgaming.org. That new forum is opened up. It's a fresh start for everybody in the OSR. Just go there and chat away. If you're tired of going to a place and having someone with 1,000 posts telling you, I don't care what you say, you only have 2 posts.
Yeah, so we've got sections for all the different versions of TSR, D&D, and other TSR games, and places for the actual podcast to talk about.
All the podcasts under the WGPRN podcast yes. family.
And we've even got some sub-forums about other TSR games and other things uh-huh. like Castles and Crusades and things like that.
All the retro clones, and we have actually some people talking about Top Secret on there right now. So
yeah, I saw that. Very interesting. And all the worlds from TSR, too.
Yeah, definitely. It's a nice little place to go to. Why don't you go there and sign up and enjoy. Yeah. Let's head into Random Encounters tonight.
We take what we want and leave the rest. Just like your salad bar.
Nothing up must leave. Presto!
You will come up no more.
What? Huh? What will come out no more?
Random Encounters.
So Random Encounters tonight. We actually don't know what our random encounter is tonight because our special guest tonight, Jonathan, in the background, quietly going, uh-oh, is going to pick his favorite monster from the BX Companion, and we're going to review it.
And again, you know, I looked at your question, Vince, and I'm sorry. I really had a hard time picking one that I liked the best.
Okay.
I mean, I'm really proud of all of them, but... Yeah. I was thinking of, I really liked how, I mean, my personal favorite, I'm not going to tell you which that one is, because it's kind of cheesy.
Extra oh. points if you say, with Liz, if you say kobolds.
No. But I would say that I'm fairly, I really like the Greater Vampire.
Greater Vampire, okay, let's go to that one then. What page is that on?
Page C45.
All right, everybody, if we flip in our books together, boop, to C45.
Yeah, flip in our books.
Okay, Greater Vampire. Here we are, Greater Vampire. Perfect, got him. So this is a custom monster that you had designed yourself.
Yeah, more or less.
So it's like a vampire lord in armor class of 1 or better, hit dice of 15 or better. Wow.
Well, it's kind of... It's the BX version of templating a character class. Mm-hmm. Combined with making a vampire lord. I mean, maybe that's not the best example if you want to talk about how it was created. It's a souped-up vampire is all it is. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, the... In other editions of the game, you see that there are, you know, characters become vampires and then they retain their class abilities and things of that nature. And that's not really part of the BX lore. The BX lore, a vampire is its own monster. It has 7 or 8 hit dice and that's about it. So where are those ultra-powerful vampires? Or how do you use a vampire in high-level play when you have a cleric that can destroy them at 14th level? And what I did with all the greater undead is they're just immune to turning, which I thought was simpler than trying to mechanically create bigger turn tables for clerics.
Awesome.
What you see in adventure modules is either character classes are restricted to a certain level in order to not defeat the undead, like, say, Ravenloft or something, mm-hmm. or else you see you have undead included that are carrying some sort of special magic amulet that makes them immune to turning. Mm-hmm. White Plume Mountain, for example.
Right.
And so I thought, why not just have some undead are too powerful to be turned?
Awesome. My personal favorite I liked out of here was the Death Lord.
Right, that's a riff off of the Death Knight from the Theme Folio in the first edition.
Yeah.
I saw that, I'm like, oh, this has definitely got to be a Death Knight. And I read it on, and I was like, yep, Death Knight all the way.
Yeah, Death Knight is, like, great.
Now, how did you know when you were writing all this up? Because I noticed when you were writing all these things up that... There's nothing to do with the open gaming license on here. At least I didn't see anything with open gaming license-wise in the copy you sent. How did you know what to stay away from and what to actually change as far as monster names? I know some of them are copyrighted by Wizards or TSR Wizards.
Right. Well, for for the most part, if the only things that the monsters that I included are monsters that filled certain niches that right. I thought were relevant for high level play, and most of them were taken from some form of actual mythology. Mm-hmm. And so whenever possible, I use the mythological name because those aren't copyrighted. Mm. You know, dark elves are something out of Norse mythology called the Dokkelfar, for example.
Right.
Or there's a monster of the South Seas that is reminiscent of Cthulhu's old, or not old ones, the Deep Ones, or this... you know, all those different Kuotoa and all those creatures from the sea. And the name of that mythological creature is the Ponatari. And so I just would use the mythological names rather than the names that people might commonly know them under D&D auspices. Then as far as, you know, things that are intellectual property of Wizards of the Coast or TSR, like Mind Flayers and things, I didn't even bother putting those in. Those are, it's fairly easy if you play BX D&D to stat up AD&D creatures for BX.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So why bother doing that? if I put anything in here that was. That you saw elsewhere, it was probably because I thought it was very pertinent or very specific or something I would very much want to use in a game, or because I frankly didn't like the original version of it that you might find in a different edition.
Right.
You know, or I wanted to make it briefer for BX, for the BX style.
Oh. So we won't be seeing any beholders in this, apparently.
No, there are no beholders.
As much as we like beholders.
No, I mean I have a Rakshasa in here because a Rakshasa is an evil spirit, and mm-hmm. I had a thing with putting spirits into the game like banshees and wendigos.
I noticed, yeah.
You know, I will say that the ogre noble is taken. The idea for that is taken directly from those old TSR action figures.
Oh, yeah.
One called the Ogre King.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was pertinent because in high-level play, you're dealing with armies of troops, you're dealing with hordes of humanoids, and you need a leader class for those creatures.
Interesting. Glenn, yeah. You have any questions?
Yeah, I think I have one or two here. Well, actually, just a comment. I really like the Demeter.
Okay, that one was wholly my creation out of my brain.
I love it. Half ogre, half dragon.
Yeah, well, actually, if anything, that was that's based on a Warhammer miniature.
Really?
The dragon ogre.
Oh, wow. Yeah. When I start playing 2E, or I may just convert that over to 2E because it's beautiful. Two-handed weapons plus it breathes fire. Wow.
Uh-oh. You guys are in love now.
Oh, we're in love now. What about you, Liz? Anything you like out of the monsters here?
Oh, there's a lot to choose from. I particularly liked the Vargulf.
I like that one too a lot.
Yeah, the werewolf variant, but, you know, you're under a curse held in thrall to a wizard. So, you know, not only do you have that, you know, interesting twist, but that could be adventures, you know, all in themselves if you decide, you know, let's find this wizard and get rid of him so we can, you know, get this person out from under his thrall. So...
Yeah, all the monsters are designed to be kind of adventure spurs, I guess. Mm-hmm. The Vargulf comes from Norse mythology. Mm-hmm. It actually comes from a book by Elizabeth Boyer called "The Sword and the Satchel," I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
But yeah, all of these, you know, the plague zombie. That's just your average zombie movie monster that. They bite you and they turn you into a zombie. That's designed to be the kind of adventure spur that you would have to deal with if you were ruling a dominion and you had a plague of zombies break out. How are you going to deal with this?
Yeah, I love these monsters, your custom monsters, because they bring so many ideas I can use for games in here now.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And thank you for putting Swamp Thing in here.
Oh, yeah, the Shambler.
You know what the funny thing is? The Swamp Thing is just a shambling mound, right? And I love that monster personally. But I was looking at, I think it's Reaper Miniatures, actually have a model called a Swamp Shambler. And I was like, wow, they made a miniature out of my book. But I think their miniature came first, and they were worried about copyright issues themselves.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay.
But you got a great selection in here.
Definitely. And, if people want to learn more about the monsters, definitely pick up the book. But we'll get more into the book in our next segment coming up in a few seconds.
And if you have any other questions about monsters, OSRgaming.org for him, and we can send him along to him.
Definitely. Or you can write us at Glenn.
At saverdiepodcast@gmail.com.
All right, let's head into the products of your imagination where we review the book in a whole now.
The meat.
The meat, yes.
Your dungeon master has placed you in a dreadfully precarious position.
Where are the Cheetos?
They're right next to you.
Well, all you do is we play the characters we talked about earlier when we run around and stuff.
I want to show you a trick Mother showed me when you weren't around.
Use your lightning bolt.
Victory is yours.
I'm attacking the darkness.
Dungeons & Dragons games. Products of your imagination.
You're not there. You're getting drunk.
Products of your imagination. I can't say what do we have this week because we already know.
Yeah, the BX Companion.
So, Jonathan, BX Companion. Uh-huh. Let's go through the process of this. You're at home, and the idea strikes you. How does this idea come to your head, and what made you decide to do this?
Well, let's see. If you go back to, like I said, when I was a kid, I started playing with the BX books. I played with them for a number of years before I really discovered there was a difference between BX and Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Right. I think a lot of people from my generation, especially younger kids who didn't have older siblings or cousins or friends that were showing them the ropes, I think a lot of us went through that particular phase where we're using the basic and expert set and throwing in the monster manual or the Dungeon Master's Guide for some magic items, but we don't really know how it all goes together because we're missing a piece here or there.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I was always fascinated by as a kid was the book said that there was this companion book that was going to come out.
Yeah.
Companion book to the Basic and Expert set, which didn't materialize until 83 or so with Frank Mentzer's version.
Right.
And they redid all of it. And my friend and fellow co-DM there had got a copy of that probably in 84, 85, and we looked at it and we liked some of it and used it and included it with our games too. At that point, we were probably playing AD&D. We'd figured out the difference. But when I returned to these games, and this is something that happened the last two or three years, like I said, when I discovered the old school Renaissance online and started reading some of the blogs and rediscovered the unique differences between editions. I ended up going back to the BX set because it's just my preferred set. It does what I needed to do in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I started thinking, boy, I really wish there had been that companion book that had been done in the same style.
Yeah.
As the basic and expert sets, because the Mentzer Companion isn't it. I don't feel that it fulfills the quote unquote promise of the Tom Moldvay, Dave Cook, Steve Marsh books. I mean, I understand why it is that it was written the way it is. And I think that Mentzer's work, the body of work, the BECMI series, is fantastic. And it's something that he can be immensely proud of, and it's a great set. I for a while there, back in the 90s, when I was starting to dip my toe back into the D&D waters, I was really into BECMI because I thought, here's a set of an edition of the game that is really complete. It is complete in so many ways that the game was never completed. And then, but what I've discovered is that I don't really want it to be complete. The best adventures that were published by TSR, I think, are the ones that completely go off the reservation, break the rules, just have weird stuff in them, and open your imagination and spur it on to other things. And to have that open-endedness, you have to have a game that's not especially complete. You right. can't say demons are all immortals, you know, that are so powerful in ability that you have to be 26 level to fight against one. If you even then, you're probably going to die. You know, I want to have little demons that show up and tease people and do bad things, like you see a demon in Moldvay's Castle Amber module. I want to have more potential or more potentiality in my game, and at the same time, I want the game to have some codification, because the BX books do codify a lot of the things that was in the original Little Brown books that were first published by Gygax and Arneson. So that being said, when I decided that I wasn't satisfied with BECMI and I decided that I wanted to play BX, I thought, you know, all these people are doing these retro clones, and why can't I just write a book? I have a word processor. Yeah. And I have some ideas, and I have an enthusiasm for it, or a passion for the project, and it just started to grow on me. And while I had tinkered with various game designs over the last 10 or 12 years, this is the first time that I was so gripped with an idea that I was able to finish it in just a couple months of writing. And I'm very pleased and proud with how it turned out.
Cool. So how closely did you follow with Mentzer's companion? Did you borrow any ideas from it, or?
The only thing that I looked at Mentzer's companion to see how he, I mean, I'm very familiar with Mentzer's companion. Let me back up. Like I said, in the 90s, I thought that particular set was the cat's meow. And what I had to do to write this book was I had to kind of deconstruct Dungeons and Dragons, at least in my own head.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I thought I might even write a book called Deconstructing D&D, but that's a project for 30 years from now or something.
Yeah. I'd love to read it.
Yeah, if anyone wants to read it, that would be. I looked at his books, and most of what I found in them I didn't like. I didn't like that the attitude that had been taken with the books. And again, I've badmouthed Mentzer on my blog before because I don't like his edition. And again, I'd just like to say for the record that I think that he's a brilliant guy, and he's made a great particular version of the game, and there are people who enjoy that version. It's just not for me.
Yeah, to each his own.
But the only things that I took out of it, I looked to see what he did to make demi-humans viable at higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not... I borrowed a bit of that idea that they can still earn experience points and improve in fighting prowess and saving throws somewhat. Mm-hmm. I did not do anything with the clans or the clan relics and things of that nature. The reason why I didn't do attack ranks for demi-humans, but for most intents and purposes, that's kind of how it turned out to be. You know, they get some multiple attacks at higher levels. And the reason why I decided to do that is because in deconstructing the game, I realized that the experience points that players earn is a reflection of their adventuring experience, what translates into combat experience. And so it makes sense for them to have some improved abilities in combat if they're getting experience points through fighting. Or saving throws are an awareness of dangers. It's not that a 15th level fighter has somehow built up an immunity to poison. He's over a first level fighter. It's just that he's more aware of the danger and doesn't get poisoned because he prevents the snake's fangs from getting deep into his throat or whatever. You know, it's ridiculous to think that one particular human has... I mean, it's not ridiculous, but it's not the way I want to play the game. I want my characters to be a little more mundane and a little less superheroic. So that being said, I thought that increased experience points should bring a benefit to demi-humans and a benefit in saving throw bonuses. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it. I'm trying to think of anything else. I did the Dominion rules differently. I did the mass combat rules differently.
Right.
I did grappling rules different. Everything in the combat section, I believe, is different from Mensur. Mm-hmm. I didn't use any of the weapon specializations, and I don't have any immortal paths. As far as the monsters go, I did ancient dragons, which are somewhat different from his huge and giant-sized dragons. And then I'm flipping through here to see if there's any other monsters or treasures that were ripped off from him. I don't think so. I think I looked at how he did the Sphinx, but then how he modeled the Sphinx, because I wanted to put a Sphinx in there since it's a classic mythological creature and you don't see it in the basic and expert books. But no, most of his high level monsters, all the giant undead creatures and poisonous undead creatures and such, I skipped them. So I guess the short answer to your question, and I told you I ramble a little bit.
No, that's fine.
Is that I skip most of the stuff Mensur put in his companion and master rules. I tried to adhere to what the hints that were given in the basic and expert sets of this would be a book that goes from level 15 to 36.
Yeah.
It would have high level monsters. It would have additional spells. It would have some new thief abilities. Fighters would get multiple attacks. And that's what I put in there.
Yeah, I noticed that you went from 15 right up to 36 as opposed to Mensur's 15 to 24, 20, whatever.
Right. There will be no master book.
No master rules.
Immortal rules. It's not, my book is not a retro clone of Mensur. It's not a recreating of Mensur's BECMI.
It's there's what was a, promised, pretty much.
We didn't think it was a recreation.
No, this is what was promised all along.
Right. It was. I thought it was more of like a Beckme, you know, Beckme version of Beck. What am I saying? A BX version of Beckme.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is what was promised all along in his eyes, his vision of what was promised all along.
Okay.
That's what I take of it.
Yeah, that's kind of it. Okay. You know, I mean, you see things like in the expert set, you know, in the description of the Efreet.
Yeah.
It says, you know, high-level magic users can summon Efreeti. And then you look in, you know, Mensur's companion set and master set, and you say, where is that? So, you know, I put in a spell, summon Efreeti. You know, nice. That kind of thing.
Nice.
So, it's published now. It's on its third printing, as I saw on your website.
Yep, third printing. I'm in like, more countries than I've ever visited. So, I've visited quite a few, so that's, I have, like, one copy in each country.
So, now that it's on its third printing and out there, what would you have done differently if you could go back and correct everything?
The only thing I would have done differently is I would have had someone else proofread it before I did the first printing. Because the first printing came out and there was, you know, I spelled horde wrong most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, someone called me for that on a video video review, video blog. And I appreciate it because I don't want there to be many misspellings. So I would have proof checked it better, or I mean had a different set of eyes, which is what I did before the second printing. And other than that, you know, I really like how it turned out. I wish I could have gotten the adventure module done for it before it was released, but I was afraid that I have a tendency to be, personally, I have a tendency to not only be a procrastinator, but be a perfectionist about things and waiting for things to be perfect before they go out. And I really thought that this was worth putting out to the public. I really thought it was like a worthwhile book, and I wanted to get it out. And I didn't, if I had waited till I got an adventure module and figured out how to do the boxes, and I mean I did figure out how to do the boxes, but to put the print labels on the boxes so it would look like the old games. Well, if I did all that, it still wouldn't be released.
I figured out how to do the boxes myself. You take an old iPad box and that's about the same size.
Well, so will we see like a revised second edition BX Companion?
A revised BX Companion? I don't think so. No, okay. It would be hard to. It would be hard to do. It would be hard to revise it. Well, I'm going to be. I have another book that's coming out. That's coming out. I have another book that I'm working on that hopefully will be coming out soon.
Oh, can you give us a little hint, a little tidbit about it, or a little teaser?
Yeah.
The book that I'm writing right now is going to be some additional. Some things that I've written about on my blog that people have enjoyed and appreciated and wished that I would compile into a single work that they could just reference rather than have to flip through pages or bookmarks or whatnot. And so that's what I'm working on right now. And the same guy who did the cover art, Brian DeClercq for the BX Companion, is doing the cover art for that book.
Do we have a name for this book, or?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us, or you can't tell us yet?
Well, sure. It's called the Complete BX Adventurer.
Oh, okay.
It's got the old Bard Games Complete Adventurer book, you know, except I'm going to spell complete in the English or American English spelling.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it's called the Complete BX Adventurer, and it has like a lot of new character classes, a lot of new spells for the new character classes. Some firearms rules and just some different stuff.
Sounds very good. I look forward to that. You have to keep us updated on this.
Yeah, well, it'll be advertised on my blog when it's ready. The blog is the miracle of the age.
Why don't you drop your URL for that blog so everybody can hear? So one can follow you. Excuse me.
Oh, the blog is. bxblackrazor.blogspot.com when it's working.
When it's working.
It's been down the last couple days, yeah.
Yeah, Blogspot has its problems sometimes.
You can't complain when it's free.
No, definitely not. Now, you mentioned you were trying to get a module out with the box set in the same time. Are you working on that as well right now? Or?
Yeah. The original Basic and Expert sets... Even the Holmes Basic set, which came out before the Moldvay version, they all included with them an adventure module, and Mentzer did too with the first two parts of the BECMI set. I don't think there weren't any adventure modules in the later books, but you know, for a kid growing up, and the Basic and Expert set being the introduction to Dungeons and Dragons. The adventure modules really helped to show how it is that you're supposed to use the rules and how it is that you're supposed to play. The basic set came with the Keep on the Borderlands, which is like a classic dungeon, and the expert set came with the Isle of Dread, which is a classic wilderness kind of adventure. So I wanted to create an adventure module for my companion set, that would show how high level play would go. Some of the features of it, some of the ways that it was different from just dungeon crawling or wilderness crawling, and show how to play at levels greater than 14th level. And I'm in the process of working on that. It's my biggest stumbling block to getting these things out, besides my day job, my family, my busy schedule. Mm-hmm. The biggest stumbling block I have is that I am not a great artist, and I am terrible about drawing maps. And so it takes it, you know, if I have to beg friends of mine to do artwork, and I have to really steel up my nerve to put pen to paper to draw maps, and that's what keeps me from finishing it up. It's not that I can't do the writing is mostly done for it, but I, like I said, I have some perfectionist tendencies. I want it to look good, and I have a hard time saying this is good enough, you know, to use.
You need stuff, just call Corey.
Yeah. So the last question I have for you, then we'll head over to Glenn or Liz for their question, is how did you... I noticed there was no D20 or open gaming license reference or anything to do with that. Aren't you worried the Wizards of the Coast might look upon this and say, hey, this doesn't follow the guidelines, you know, this is blah, 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 copyright, blah, 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 we're Wizards of the Coast, here's our giant briefcase?
No, is the short answer. I'm not you. There's no. I'm not a copyright attorney. So I'm not. I didn't want to put any kind of legalese in my book that I don't really fully understand. I mean, that's the honest truth. That and the fact that an extra page of legalese would have been an extra page that I'd have to take out of the book because I didn't want it to be more than 64 pages.
Right.
Having said that, I did my best not to infringe on any of their intellectual property, so I don't think there's anything to sue me over.
Well, the reason why I ask, because Osric, obviously you know about them, and Sword and Wizardry and Castle Crusade, all of them went out of their way to do the ascending armor class as opposed to the descending, and when they reference certain things, they changed it around to comply, and you left it all in, so that was my main concern and question there.
Yeah, no, there have been other role-playing games that have been invented and published that, you know, use a 20-sided dice to attack people, or have armor class hit points, saving throws. I look at Palladium or half a dozen different fantasy knockoff role playing games and say this is just D&D with like a skill system tacked onto it.
Yeah.
So I'm not if those guys are still in business, the rule is that you can't copyright a game system. You can only copyright the text. You can't copyright an idea, and I'm not trying to infringe on their intellectual property. I'm not even using the term Dungeon Master in my game. I did change that to Dragon Master.
Yeah, I noticed that, which was kind of cool. I like that, yeah.
But, you know, everything else I use is either my own or it's pretty open content as far as I'm concerned. Okay. Now, the one complaint I received from some folks was that by not using the open gaming license, I am preventing people from using my system to create adventures or campaign settings or supplements of their own based on my rules. Because really? My game isn't open to other people to use. Well, but I'm willing to talk to people if they want to email me with an idea or something and check it out and sign off on things. Mm-hmm. I'm not a total jerk.
I wouldn't see if someone wanted to write an adventure, say, you know, you need the BX companion to run this. I don't think you'd be that upset. I mean, it'd be free advertisement for you in a sense.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is that I'm not really interested in I mean, the only thing that I'm protective about here is maybe quality control, I guess, but
yeah.
It's not like I'm making a crap load of money on this or something.
No, you know.
My wonderful artists who did great work in this book, and without whom it wouldn't have turned out nearly as nice as it is. You know, they didn't get paid with anything more than a free book. And that's because I'm not making much money on this. So I suppose Wizards of the Coast could sue me or something, but there's not much they're going to get out of it.
And that's pretty much standard fandom anyway. You know, I used to do some stuff for fanzines, and you know, you got paid in free copy. And
yeah,
generally any money that was made, you know, would barely have covered the cost of printing them and mailing them to the people who ordered. So, you know, certainly not unusual.
My hope was to make enough money to cover the printing costs and, if possible, cover the cost of a new printing so that it could finance my own writing hobby. And I managed to do that, and that has been all I could hope for right now.
Oh, cool. So when we order, go to your website and order the book, you get an actual copy mailed by you to their house, or
mailed by hand from me? Yeah.
Oh, wow, cool.
I got a mail run today. I got 4 copies that have to go out.
Cool.
Oh, wow.
Liz, you have some questions?
Not questions necessarily, but I did want to mention, going over this, one of the things that I really enjoyed about your companion rule set was that you went into more detail than Mincer did in his regarding dominions and strongholds. And, I mean, it's like he had a very brief couple of paragraphs about strongholds and then went on to, you know, other stuff. But you spend a lot more time on, you know, what a dominion would, you know, comprise of, and, you know, certain things about how your dominion would create income, and, you know, stuff that higher level, you know, people would usually have to spend a little bit of time dealing with, even if they would prefer being on the road adventuring most of the time. So mm-hmm. I liked that, and also your section on creating and researching spells for high-level magic users. I thought that was a very nice addition as well.
Yes, it was.
I'm flipping through my book to see what I wrote. Oh, yeah. Well, and you know, okay, well, let me thank you, Liz. I appreciate the compliments. You know, Mencer's book is... And the Rule Cyclopedia, if you have that, I think there's a retro clone of that out now, Delving Deeper, Darker, or something.
It's not quite out yet. They're still working on it.
Okay, but you know that those rules are very mechanically inclined. A lot of them are based on just formula. You know, you have so many hexes. Each hex is worth so much as far as resources go. You add it all up, it provides you with an income, and then for some strange reason you earn experience points for that income. And my main point was just to, I wanted to make clear that there's a difference between earning money as a barber and or a stronghold or a dominion ruler and earning money by going on adventures. I mean, only one gives you experience points in my book. And that's what I wanted to. I really wanted to convey that in this particular companion set. I didn't want people to just be sitting on their duffs, earning Boku experience points and going up in levels. I don't think that every king has to be a 25th level person. In the original basic set, there's a monster listed in the monster list called the Noble. A noble is a human who's a 2-hit dice monster. And that works for me. You don't need to be a 30th level anything to be a Dominion ruler. You just have to be born into a particular family. A lot of the stuff I took as far as what income is for... I was basing that on the rules that were given in the little brown books of the original D&D set.
Right.
You know, the basic and expert sets are just those three books, except a little more polished and cleaned up, and, you know, with Moldvay and Cook and Marsh's particular spin on them, or their particular stylistic stuff added onto them. But they're... You know, a lot of the things, there were some things that got left out of the basic and expert sets that were in the little brown books, and I tried to put those into the game, into my book, I should say.
Yeah.
And that includes, you know, rules for how much income people are getting from their families or from their dominion holders, peasants, whatever.
Cool.
Very nice. Very nice. Very nice.
The magic thing, you know, again, I wanted to leave it loose so that people can come to their own conclusions of how to create a magic mirror that works as a gate to a different plane, or how to create a flying ship.
Right.
You know, as I said earlier, I really like that open-endedness and spurring people's imagination rather than telling them it takes 10,000 gold pieces worth of material for every 10 feet of magical shipbuilding material. You know, I didn't want to do that much codification of it. I think that part of the charm of those BX books is that it's so open-ended. And I wanted to keep that open-endedness in my book, too.
Okay.
That's something that Mentzer doesn't. I'm saying that to contrast with Mentzer's version, with the Mentzer version, which does have very specific rules as far as building giant flying ships, for example, or flying castles, or
right.
You know, that
thing. Glenn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to add, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thumbing through your supplement here, because I'm not as familiar with the different versions of D&D as my comrades here. I'm mostly the Mentzer rule cyclopedia guy.
All right.
I don't know if this has been in other editions, but I really like the optional rule about variable combat damage. I've never seen anybody do it by class before.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering where did you get that? How did you come up with that?
I blogged about it first.
Okay. Okay.
My blog is like where I go to work thoughts out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes in my free flow writing, I come up with ideas. But actually, that particular one, I can take credit for putting it in a book, I guess. But the idea itself is something that was broached in an old Dragon magazine. And if I could find the entry in my blog, I'm pretty sure I reference it. But there's an old Dragon magazine that said, you know, that had a couple articles on how to allow other types of character classes to have a less limited scope of weapons. And they postulated the idea that that there's nothing that really, it's not like a magic user can't pick up a hand axe and it's going to burn his hand or something. There's nothing. It's not like a vampire trying to drink holy water. It's just a matter of a game convention. And so why is that game convention there? And so for people who want to have their sword-swinging wizard or a holy cleric that carries a cruciform sword, you know, I think that optional rule is something to put in there.
No.
And so I took it basically from a Dragon magazine, but then I cleaned it up a little bit.
That's very nice, very nice. Now, if second edition had this instead of skills and powers, this would have worked a lot better.
Sure.
it's just so simple. I'm sorry, go ahead, Liz.
Oh, I was going to say, it also works out, you know, Mike, you know, several years ago, once played a magic user who really, really wanted to be a fighter. And so he would always try to attack with a sword and only use his magic as a last resort, because he really would have rather have been a fighter than a magic user, but he just wasn't really good at it.
That was, that was a role-playing choice for his character?
Yes.
A perfect choice? Okay.
So, this system would have just worked really well for using the damage that, his character would have done with the sword, as opposed to going with the, okay, you take off, minus whatever because you're a mage, and, well, you've got a high dex, so plus this, and da-da-da-da-da, and, it was pretty, involved, but it was AD&D when we were playing that particular, set of characters.
Right.
But something like this, it would really have streamlined it a lot, and you still would have gotten the general idea.
Yeah, it's still. I know a lot of people use the variable weapon damage, and so if you're going to go that route, then allowing wizards to use swords or allowing clerics to use two-handed great axes or whatever, that does kind of infringe a little bit on the specialty of the all weapon using characters, and so this is kind of a way to allow that so that it doesn't infringe on the player's particular style. I don't want someone to say, "Oh, I had a vision of my wizard using an axe or a sword. Why can't I?" I've over the last couple of years I've played with a lot of new people who like kids, really. Young kids and teenagers who have never played these games before, and all they know are cartoons or comics or whatever, and they say, "Why can't I use a sword?" I'm like, "You can. You just do less damage,
Yes.
And actually, I in my own games, I basically have lifted all weapon restrictions anyway. And nice. I just use D6 damage for everything.
Nice. Oh, you're doing the Holmes thing then. The
D6. That's the standard from the basic set.
Yeah, for original.
Mm-hmm. The variable damage is an optional rule.
That's true.
So I think I give a plus one bonus to two-handed weapons since they strike last in melee combat.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's all D6 and it works pretty good.
Cool.
It works really well, actually. That's why I'm doing that.
Oh, I also want to thank you for your blog entry about our little interview here.
Oh, sure.
I was reading it over. It's very interesting. Vince, you had something about Mr. Mitzer?
No, just you were saying how you addressed him in some of your posts, and I was just wondering what you... I haven't read every one of your posts, so and you had touched upon it briefly in the beginning.
Well, it just seems like every time I mention... Beckmi, BECMI, Menser's work, or the Rules Cyclopedia, it's always with bile in my throat. So,
sure, that isn't Vince's blog.
I don't hate Beckmi.
It's not that. It's that there. It's just that when I do blog about there, I'm often saying something less than complimentary about it, and right. It's not all There are a couple things here. One is that, I've written things that are just really over the top, which is kind of that's what you do when you're blogging.
Yeah.
Drum up the readership. And also just venting, into cyberspace. So I'll say things that are over the top, like, he betrayed people by creating this version of the companion or something. And no, he didn't betray anyone. And his book is great, and it was the right set for its time. And he was constrained in his writing by, working for a company that had parameters he had to follow. I don't think they wanted just one book. I think they wanted to have a companion set and a master set. I mean, you sell twice as many box sets that way.
I think that's what he had mentioned in one of his interviews we did with him.
Right.
I think with the Roll for Initiative podcast, he mentioned that Gary told him that they wanted this book, that book, and this book done by a certain time.
Yeah, and so if you're working under those kind of creative restraints, you can't blame a person if it creatively looks, you know, like it was hamstrung a little bit. And I don't fault Mensur, or I don't think he did anything bad. And I just, because I don't play his edition of the game, doesn't mean it's not a worthy game to be played. That's what I really wanted to say. I think that it's a great game. I think he did. I think that it's really good for people who like to have a well-defined game set. Yeah. For me, I want something a little more loosey-goosey around the edges, I guess.
Yeah, the main thing I noticed that you posted is you said after you listened to the interview, your thoughts about him kind of changed.
Yeah, well, and that's, again, the other thing is that, you know, I've also written more than once that during that time period, about 85, 86, you know, they made the D&D line became a bit more, not juvenile, but more family friendly.
Yeah.
And you know, in, if you read through Moldvay's examples in the basic book, the Red Book, mm-hmm. you know, there's somebody, one of the player characters is getting killed every single encounter.
Yeah.
Every encounter someone dies. And like in the basic, that they don't say your characters are going to die. It says your characters are heroes and you are going to smite evil. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that's one way to play the game. And if you want to play the game like that, then by all means do so. But I like my dungeon delving a little grittier and a little dirtier. It tends to be that way anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I play in a bar with guys who are in their mid-30s, but it tends to be, you know, tends to be a little off-color, and I want an off-color game, you know. And so I have written before that I didn't like the direction TSR took with a line, making it more heroic, more glamorous. But I understand why they did it. It was the times. It was what was selling at the time. It sold a ton of books. And so you can't really fault someone for their style choice. You know, for some people, that style choice works. And so just because my style preference is a little grimmer or grittier or darker or whatever, you know, that doesn't mean that mine is the best. And sometimes I write like it is, and that's not true.
Hmm. Okay. I
write what's best for me so that, you know, and people who are into that, they can follow what I write.
You guys have any other last-minute questions for him? Or?
No.
Glenn?
Want to plug your blog one more time?
Sure, it's bxblackraiser.blogspot.com.
And we can get the BX Companion directly through you, or
you can get it directly from the blog. There's a there's a PayPal button on there that says buy now.
Mm-hmm.
That does not donate any money to my blog. I don't advertise on my blog except my own book. And so just you know, all you gotta do is hit buy now and it'll give you a book, and I'll mail it to you.
And you're doing strictly hard copy on this? No PDFs? Mm-hmm. No.
It's all hard copy, soft cover.
Physical copy.
It will be available as a PDF at some point in the future, but that time is to be determined.
Okay. And there'll be no chance of a future, like, immortality-type path in your book? Just curious.
You know, it's funny, before we ever saw the Immortal Rules, you know, we were already, when I was a kid, we were already pursuing paths of immortality using the rules and the Deities and Demigods books.
Yeah.
That idea was already percolating through our brains, and I think it's still an interesting quest, if you will, for characters, but I'm not going to put together any kind of rote form of how that's going to go down. I'm going to allow every particular dungeon master to determine how that works or if that works for their own game, and I don't want to put it in a book.
Yeah, I often wondered and did start writing some things down for an immortality path for a BX edition, but I kind of lost steam a while back, so
Yeah, you know, I did. See, I'll tell you again. I used to be a big Beckme fan, and I've written essays and stuff for Vault of Pandeus that are still up there. Mm-hmm. And I think I did some stuff for Immortality on that. But yeah, I'm not interested in it right now for the BX set. Okay. We're more down to earth. Or weirder. Normal humans encountering the weird and wondrous. Yeah. And dangerous.
Okay. Well, I guess that's going to conclude the interview and your time on the show. Thank you for coming and sitting with us and talking about your book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
we
thank
appreciate you.
You
being here.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you. I was flattered that you actually invited me when you had some really big big names in the business there. I just got one book.
I'm a big BX fanboy, so once I saw the companion in a post on a forum, I was like, what? So.
All right.
And you can get his book or ask him a question or whatever at bxblackrazorblogspot.com or at our OSR gaming forums.
Hey, just by the way, did you guys like the art in the book?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I thought it was great.
Yeah. I thought it was very, very reminiscent of the old school, you know, D&D, AD&D art. You know, I thought it really added to the flavor of, you know, the publication. I liked it a lot.
The artist did a great job. I just want to say again that this book would not be the same without them. And they're all credited in the book, and they all have websites somewhere on the internet if anyone's interested in looking them up for work.
Okay.
Yeah, they're great.
Okay. Cool. Well, thanks for sitting in with us, and we'll conclude this and say goodnight, everybody.
Thanks.
Goodnight, everybody.
Good night.
If you have any comments, please email saveordiepodcast@gmail.com or visit saveordie at saveordie.info. Follow the cast on Facebook / Save or Die Podcast, or follow them on Twitter @TheEvilDM.